You're listening to This Motorcycle Life, conversations about why we ride. Episode 26, East of Omaha. I'm Bruce Philp. Thanks for listening. Well, if you've got a sharp ear, you will have picked up this episode's title as a lyric from Bob Seger's Turn the Page. Seger is one of legions of rock and roll musicians going all the way back to Elvis Presley and maybe further, who secretly, or not so secretly, ride motorcycles. It's a classic piece of rock star imagery. But have you ever wondered what's behind it, or if it's even real? In a moment, you're going to meet someone who can answer those questions from personal experience. This was a really fun conversation, and I can't wait to share it with you. But first, of course, we have a couple of important pieces of business. I want to say thank you, as always, for your kind notes and podcast ratings. There are too many to mention all of them here, partly because of the hiatus we've just had. But I especially appreciated some recent comments on iTunes. Shout out to LazyEye84, Slick Pig, Dartuck, Morgan Ida, and RoadKing1956, whoever you may be. I've also had some inspiring emails over the last couple of months, too, and a special shout-out to a new friend here in Ontario whose name I can't mention here. The reason for that will become clear when I have a chance to share his stunning story, which I hope will be soon. I also have a bit of an announcement to make. Loyal listeners will know that I usually include a promotional message at about this point in the podcast, often on behalf of my friends at Eat Sleep Ride. But as this audience has grown, it's got me thinking that maybe we can use this platform to do some good. So, from now on, this moment in the show will be dedicated to the Movember Foundation, a global charity that focuses on men's reproductive cancers and suicide prevention. You may recognize them as the charity partner for the annual Distinguished Gentleman's Ride. Now, I know there are lots of worthy causes out there, but I chose this one both because people I care about have fought some of these battles, and because the foundation has deep roots in the motorcycle community. I hope this is something you can get behind too. I think we can help them by building a bit of awareness. But for those of you who've written to ask whether I have a Patreon page, I'd say if you feel moved to pay something for this content, make a donation instead. You'll find links for this in my show notes and my weekly newsletter. And if you're feeling especially generous, I'm working with the foundation to set up some individual country pages so that you can get a tax receipt for where you live. Tax receipt. Two words I never thought I'd say on this podcast. Okay, let's go. So the better you know me, the more absurd this confession is going to sound, but here it is. I have always fantasized about being a rock star. I was wise enough to realize early on that having no talent and being an introvert were going to be obstacles to this dream, but still. The idea of filling an arena with guitar virtuosity to the delight of thousands of screaming fans, well, in some parallel universe, that's what I'm doing right now. And waiting out back to help me escape autograph seekers in that universe is a motorcycle. Because that's the kind of rock star I want to be, a brooding poet with a loaded six-string on my back. Sorry, Bon Jovi. In need of nothing more than a tank of gas, three chords, and the truth. Well, obviously that's not how things worked out for me, but happily some people do live that life, and for more of them than you might imagine, a motorcycle is a big part of how they do it. I've always thought that that would be fun to talk about, and thanks to the TML playlist and a bit of luck, I finally got my chance. Mark Kaspersick is the frontman for alt-rock band Red Light King. And more than a decade ago, this proud son of Hamilton, Ontario, loaded his motorcycle and guitars into a van and headed for Los Angeles to, in his words, take the shot. Well, since then, Red Light King has appeared on Billboard charts multiple times, performed on The Tonight Show and Late Night with Conan O'Brien, had their music featured in films like The Italian Job, Draft Day, Iron Man 3, and The Avengers, and provided musical inspiration to teams from just about every major professional sports league in North America. These days, though, there's no easy ride in the music business, and Kaz is still very much a working musician, so I was fortunate to catch him in the middle of preparing to release a new album. and very happy to discover that we've all got more in common than I would have guessed. I reached Mark Kasprzyk at his home in Culver City, California. Hey, Kaz, how are you doing?
Hey, Bruce, how are you?
I'm great. I'm not quite as warm as you are, but I'm great. Thanks for making the time to talk to me today. I know you're busy. You got a new album coming out this month, and you've been so enthusiastic about doing this, but I'm pretty sure that it's you doing me the favor. So thanks for your time and for the conversation we're about to have.
Not at all.
Well, I do appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. We're all in it together, and we're talking.
Yeah,
motorcycles and music and life, and we could sit here and talk all day. So yeah, that's my pleasure.
Well, that's awesome. Yeah, motorcycles and music, kind of our life. So let's get to know you as a rider first. So by the time people are hearing this, I will have explained a bit about who you are professionally. So let's set the table with a bit about you as a rider. How did you start, and how's it been part of your life since then?
Well, I was always fascinated with motorcycles, and ever since I was a kid, we all started riding BMXs and flat landing and freestyling and building jumps and crashing all the time to our mother's discontent. And my mom was a nurse in the ER for 40 years. Well, she was an x-ray nurse, but she also worked the ER. So God forbid I ever ride a motorcycle growing up, that was kind of like by her saying, if you do, you can just move out. That was kind of like, well, then you always want to disobey your parents, a part of you anyways, growing up.
Yeah.
For me, it was like, I just thought they were the coolest. And my father was a drag racer, so at the drags, I'd see a lot of drag bikes. And to me, those guys were the most insane guys, because those bikes were going sideways down the track a quarter mile and running so fast, as fast as dragsters, So, yeah, just a massive obsession. But I never started riding, like I said, because we were car guys. So to me, it was like build a hot rod first, because that's what we knew and that's what was around. So I didn't start riding until I was about 25. And my first machine, to set that up was after my first record came out on Sony, during the second record, in like 2004. So I've only been riding like 15 years ish. Mm. So, with my own machine. So around 2004, 2005, I had an apprenticeship at Johnny Cool Choppers in Burlington, Ontario with my now very good friend Steady. And, he has, knuckleheads and panheads, and he's a Harley aficionado, a true encyclopedia. So I had an amazing teacher. So when I went there, and I saw him kickstarting an old knucklehead with a linker carb and then surfing it down over the Skyway Bridge and stuff, standing on his machine, I was just like, okay, so this is what I'm going to do now. So that's kind of how I got into riding. It's hot rods first, saw him at the drag strip, massive obsession. Got an apprenticeship, became really good friends with Steady. He built this old panhead that he had lying around, but it was very car themed, And by that, I mean, he had shovelhead tanks on it, but it had 51 badges. He had a 34 Ford taillight on it. It was a bobber, a traditional bobber in the sense that it was period correct.
Right.
So I became obsessed with that machine. And at the time, I had a 49 Mercury pickup truck that I built and chopped and drove back and forth to California twice. So the machine was proven. Had a 302 in it. And I traded him that truck for the panhead. So then I was in. So although I had ridden a few motorcycles before that and had my license, the panhead was my first bike. So it was a jockey shift, foot clutch, four speed Harley Davidson. And so to learn on that to do the dance, you know, with drum breaks, I was jumping in the fire.
Yeah.
And I was instantly hooked, instantly obsessed. Like, it became a way of life for the next few years while I established myself in the U.S. And that's kind of how I got started riding. Just jumped in.
Wow. You know, that, so you're from Hamilton, Ontario, which, you know, which by now the listeners will know, cause I'll talk a bit about that, but you know, it's a town full of, you know, guys who work with their hands, and you know, that really sounds like the story for you, and you're pretty attached to that bike. You brought it with you to California and you still ride it, right?
Yeah, I do. I ride the machine, and since then I've rebuilt it. You know, I know every nut and bolt on that bike. I don't know every bike. But, you know, that bike got me into a lot of, it allowed me to meet people of the same sort of ethos. So when I came to Hollywood, and that's a whole story in itself, because how I got the bike over the border, and I don't want to incriminate myself, you know, but I basically brought the bike over in a van. And for the show in Long Beach, there's a Long Beach motorcycle tattoo show called Ink and Iron. And in 2008, I shoved the panhead in the back of the van, and I got it registered for the Ink and Iron show. And I came over the border and then drove to California to show the bike. But really, it was to, you know, get the bike to the U.S. And then later, I had to import it legally so I could plate it. So it was California plated. So that's a whole lengthy process. And now I'm very educated on the subject. The same with immigration law. It took me 10 years and over $20,000 to get my green card and a lot of work, you know, which is a whole nother podcast. But, you know, getting the bike over the border was my goal, because I love the bike and I wanted to have it here and ride it. And I still do. And like I said, it's allowed me to meet a lot of people in the arts community, in the hot rod community, in the music community. So I started working at, Power Plant Choppers in Hollywood and Thunder Road, and met a lot of my now very, very good friends through that motorcycle, through just understanding it, knowing it, and living it. I was probably at the time the only guy who had a jockey shift old bobber as a daily driver. Most of the guys in California were riding newer bikes, and then on the weekend they'd ride their chopper. But they all thought I was nuts, because I'm screaming down the highway in fourth gear, doing 80 miles an hour, just trying to keep up to them. And, you know, and knowing I can't stop because the brakes are drum brake light switches from 1950. And, it becomes a part of your personality, I'd say. Don't you think?
Yeah. Oh, 100%. It totally does. And I hear that from people who listen to this show. I think it's maybe one of the reasons that they like it, is because we kind of acknowledge that you know, writing isn't what you do. It's kind of who you are.
Right.
So I want to talk just for a minute about Born to Rise. So I know, you know, it's been a few years since you recorded that track, but it seems like a perennial favorite for motorcyclists, you know, based on the YouTube comments. You've had more than 5 million views of that video, which is amazing. And it kind of sparked the idea for this episode in a way. So for me, I mean, it's a great fist pumping piece of arena rock. But to me, the video made that song about motorcycles. And so I'm just curious to know, were bikes in your mind when you wrote it, or did that kind of come later?
I mean, it was, and you know, I would ride my old pan to the studio, and I was recording at this old studio. It's called TTG Studios. It was built by this famous engineer called Bill Putman, and Neil Young recorded Harvest Moon there, and The Doors recorded there, and Hendrix recorded there. And so you can imagine this old soulful double brick building, three-story building in Hollywood, with hardwood floors, and then you peer into the parking lot, and there's these beat up old cars. Like there was a 37 Packard and a 48 Pontiac convertible, and then my Panhead, you know, parked out. So it created this atmosphere that was like genuinely authentic to sort of, you know, envisioning music from a visual sense and in a literal sense. And it kind of becomes one piece as you create it. Mm. So yes, to answer your question in a very short answer, yes. Yes, I thought about motorcycles, but I also thought about like just camaraderie. I also thought about, you know, whether it's, you know, you're training and you're on a team sport, or it's football, or whether you're in the military and you've got to really count on these other people for your survival. I just think it was just about trying to bring people together, and how I knew it at the time was me, you know, gaining friends in this genre of riding. So I got a hold of my buddy, Strati Avartos, who's an amazing director of photography here in Los Angeles. And, he's a military guy, and he was riding with these guys called Unknown Riders.
Right.
Shout out Unknown. So these guys were one of the early cat. These guys are doing the catwalks and running 12 o'clocks on Harley FXRs. They kind of started it. It was right around the time, which was probably like 2010, 2011. And they started, you know, they were doing crazy stuff on Harley. Because until then, this sport stunt riding was like Japanese bikes primarily and sport bikes, right? Mm-hmm. And they would jack them up and frame them out. And these guys were doing the same stuff on mildly altered factory Harley Davidson. So I got to know those guys, and they loved the song. And so they jumped in the video right away. So then from there, we started to piece together the video. We're like, let's have these guys in it. I'll be right here. Let's go here. Let's do this. And then we're like, where are we going to do these crazy stunts with all these cameras around where we don't get totally kicked out by the cops, you know?
Right.
And how much are these permits going to cost? And how much is insurance going to cost? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So our way around that was we went up to an Indian reserve just north of like Riverside area. And we got to know the community there, and they let us use their land, and they have their own police department. So they were just like, yeah, do whatever you want. And we threw some of the cats in the video, and it became like another thing where people came together for this, you know, just cool music video where we featured friends and family and just uniting people of different culture, different race, and different types of bikes, but mostly obviously steel Harleys, et cetera, but a lot of custom stuff too. And it became an event. And then there's a cat. It's funny because now I'm throwing back. I'm sort of forgetting everyone's names because now it's been, you know, several years, right? Yeah, since we did it. So I wish I should have probably better prepared for that. But there was a director of photography who shoots Twitch, freestyle jump rider, and he got a hold of a helicopter pilot, and so we got this helicopter. Now we've got a camera up in a helicopter, and we're filming us from the sky. And I'm like, oh, this video is insane now, but people are pulling favors. We're not like paying hundreds of thousands of dollars for this stuff. They were just really genuinely excited about the song, and the community kind of got around it. So, you know, we paid for the gas for the chopper.
Right.
And then the story just goes from there. So you got a video that looks like we spent $1 million on it, but we didn't. And we got some of the best riders in the world. And, it was so much fun to shoot. And then, on the last day, there was an old bridge on the reserve, and I ended up surfing my bike over the reserve. I surfed the bridge three times. And And by then I was pretty exhausted too. So I kind of like, I had to be a little focused there. And that bridge wasn't the sturdiest thing. On the last shot, they had the guys behind me were riding behind me while I was standing on the bike. And we're in about third gear and we're doing about 30 miles an hour over this bridge. And there's, you know, there's about 20 to 30 guys behind me on the last shot. And the bridge is just shaking.
No.
And it was like, it was super nerve wracking, but it was still a lot of fun. And I got a lot of respect for that, you know, from those guys. And that was kind of neat.
Are you still in touch?
Hang out. Yeah. I'm still in touch with mostly everyone on that camp. On the unknown guys and the video team.
Yeah.
You know, we're getting ready to shoot a new video here too. So there might be some motorcycles in it. I know we're talking to Harley and stuff, so we might get them to lend us some stuff.
Boy, I hope they do. They need all the love they can get right now. But you know, that too is another podcast. Sure. The Unknown Industry guys are cool. I didn't know much about them until I did some research for this conversation, and it's quite a story. And they've got, you know, they're kind of a business now. They're doing, you know, apparel and stuff like that. But those guys can ride.
Brand. Everybody's branding now. You have to be a brand.
Yeah, that's right.
It's true. I'm like, yeah, I know, part of me, you know, I don't always want to participate in social media, but now it's become part of the job. So
yeah,
I get it.
Yeah.
No. I get it. But sometimes you just want to ride, like, you know, you don't want to film it, take pictures of it. You just do it because of the soulfulness of it. When I first moved here, I pulled the bike out and I ran the PCH on the Panhead, and it was amazing. It was like kind of like a dream come true. It wasn't even about my career or my music. Just having got there with that machine was an event. No one was around to see it. It was for me.
Yeah.
It was like, I'm here. I actually made it here and I'm riding this motorcycle, because we didn't come for money. You know what I mean? It wasn't like California was a pipe dream.
Yeah.
So something people talk about, but a lot of people don't get out of Hamilton. A lot of my friends can't even cross the border. You know, so it's like, for me to be there riding the motorcycle, pulling gears along the coast of California with the sun out, and I'm in a t-shirt and Vans, you know, I'm just like, this is it, you know. And sometimes I try to go back to those moments in my life and just try to remember that feeling.
Yeah,
because that's important, because as time moves on, we tend to forget.
Well, yeah, and I think people probably don't appreciate what a hard life it is to do what you do, and I think it makes all the sense in the world that you'd want to try to stay in touch with you know, that positive stuff. And I know what you mean about that ride. I mean, it's so touristy, yeah. And people who live in Southern California, you know, probably don't get it, but I always feel like I'm in a movie on that road. So I gotta believe that.
Isn't it great?
It is.
Like, the further north you go up. Yeah. When you go up to, like, you know, even past Malibu, and like you got Leo Creel and Zuma and all that.
Yeah.
You start going up there. It starts, and then you can ride all the way up to like Hearst Castle, and actually coming back is even better, right? Because you're in the right lane.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And you're on the water. So coming down is even touristy or not. It's like, yeah, no, you're right. I mean, look, I've been here 11 years now, and none of my friends go to the beach ever. You know, they don't go to the beach, and I'm like, hey, you know what? We should go to the beach today because we live in California.
Yeah, that's
like,
it.
None of them go, because it's like when was the last time you went to Niagara Falls?
Yeah.
And we're like, oh my God, Niagara Falls. you just don't care.
That's right.
After a while.
That's right. I wanted to circle back to one sort of scene. I think you kind of half answered this question, but you know, you said that you'd surfed your bike across that bridge. But what you didn't mention was, you know, well, so it was a bridge and you were being followed by a helicopter, which was flying sideways while they shot you. And all I could think about when I watched that scene is that this must have given your team a heart attack. I mean, you're the property, right?
What made you do that? She knew I had surfed my bike before. My mother had a heart attack. You know who got the biggest cow? Was my record label.
Right.
They lost their mind. They go, if we'd known you were going to do that, we would have pulled the shit down. Like, they lost it. And consequently, the next video to insure me, because we were doing it on train tracks, they wanted $14,000 for 4 hours to insure me because they thought I was going to jump off the train. we're like, that's half our video budget. What are we talking about here? Yeah. I'm not going to jump on the train. But so it was definitely, my mom is kind of like, in my life, is kind of just given up worrying, actually, you know, with the lifestyle that I've led. She's just like, that's Mark. That's Marky. He's off doing crazy stuff. So she's been good. Mom's been good. But yeah, it was a lot of fun. And the only thing that I hate about it was they didn't do a close up on that shot, but it's cause I had surfed a couple times and, you know, with editing and videos, they get really expensive really fast.
Yeah.
And so in the record label setting, you have about, you've got like two changes, maybe three times where you can go back and forth before they go, yeah, we're not spending $10,000 on the edit, dude. Like, which is a shame because how many times do movies get edited? Probably a lot more.
Yeah.
Dozens, maybe, you know, the reshoots, blah, 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 blah. You know, music videos, we don't have that luxury and that's fine. But I thought we did great. I thought the whole team did really good. That was a fun one. The song is over the top, but you know, they use the song at all kinds of sporting events still. The military's used it in a lot of videos. The military's used it in training videos. The Mighty Ducks used to come out to that song. The Nashville Predators came out to that song. So, I mean, I'll be watching a game. I was watching the Auburn, Alabama game a couple of years ago. It came on the field after they won. I was like, this song, it's kind of everywhere and it's kind of nowhere. Like, it's one of those songs that, not really a super known song, but people know it. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's been nice.
I mean, it's a great gateway drug, I think, to your music. And I guess, you know, if you're, you know, I guess when you make it in this business, everybody's got their stairway to heaven. So, you know, maybe this is going to be yours. I think,
for me, Old Man was a big break for us, but go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. Brilliant. I actually want to touch briefly on Old Man in a second. I just love that. And I love that Neil Young was up for it. So, bridging question. I think I read somewhere that you recorded Born to Rise after you'd been on the road for a long time. And I wondered, you know, watching the video, and I think you kind of touched on this earlier, is being in a band on the road a little bit like riding with a crew of some kind? I mean, I want to say gang, but that word's got a lot of freight. Are there parallels? Is there anything to that?
That's a great question, Bruce. Yes and no. I think, you know, like riders have their own personality and character, but in one way, yes, that in the fact that I don't really love riding with people I don't know, just as people, because sometimes your riding your personality affects your riding, and everybody's kind of got their own way to ride. I think when you ride with experienced guys around the same kind of, you know, influences and belief systems as far as the way they ride, like some guys are really safe by the book, you know, staggered, hand signals, you know, they're going, other guys are just a little more natural. and especially if you're running like crazy in California, if you're running big twists and turns, you know, you don't want a guy to get into you. If for a second he stops paying attention, you know?
Yeah.
I ride with a lot of guys with older machines because they're listening to their machine. And on a newer bike, you can actually be less aware and less defensive just because of the fact that it's running so efficiently and it's so smooth and so forgiving. Whereas a lot of these older motorcycles we ride, these Pans, Knuckles, and Shovels, they're doing so much and they're coughing and burping and there's so much going on and the braking that you're always hypersensitive about what's around you and your machine itself. So in that way, when we're playing with a band, I want to play with experienced players because they understand something that's just grander than knowing how to play the notes. If you can go down the road and stay up, that's great. You know, if you can play a Beatles song, that's great. But if there's, you know, guys with 10 years experience, those are the guys that I generally play with in the band. Mm. And even though we may have slightly different agendas, we're there together to unite the cause. And so for that reason, I definitely see parallels. Yeah.
Mm. Interesting. That makes a ton of sense. And, you know, it's funny. When I asked the question, I was thinking about life on the road, but you answered it about playing, which makes a ton more sense. I think that's a really interesting perspective.
Yeah, because that's all it is. I mean, life on a road. I mean, like, look, man, we're going to get on each other's nerves no matter what. We're dudes, you know, and we have lives outside of the road that are stressful and things are going on. One of the players' girlfriends pissed off in that day, or maybe it was one of the guys' mom's sick. You know, we're all going through life on the road, which makes it very difficult. We're not home. We're living out of a suitcase. Some days we get a good take. Some days we don't. Sometimes we're driving in a storm. We're going, you know, we have to do a 16-hour day, load in, play, and get in the van and drive, you know, till 6 in the morning to the next gig. Pass out till sound check. And it's like, sometimes it's awful. It's awful, but that's also part of the fight and part of the reason why, you know, when it's good, you know, you've earned it, you know? And I don't think riding's like that. I don't think people are that extreme. They want to go. I think riding is a little more of a luxury. I think maybe back in the day when there were packs of nomads, that would probably be more like it. I think being a musician, especially a working musician, that's a national touring act, I think it's more difficult. And so for those reasons, I think there's more unity there, but also more heavier falling out. It's just more extreme.
Yeah.
Right. And I think when you get a couple buddies and you go, hey, we're going to ride up the coast this week, take a week, go home, you know, I think it's just different. It's totally situational. So,
yeah.
You know, I totally respect people that make riding and building and working on motorcycles their everyday thing, who they are, not just like a fad, like they went to the store, they bought their bike, you know what I mean? And then they go to work, you know, like it's completely different. Not that I don't appreciate those people too, because they have an understanding of it and they're living their life. So I'm not judging that either. I think I'm somewhere in the middle, because if I had to choose, I'll always choose being a musician.
Right.
You know, I'm not a one percenter. That's a lifestyle that is also extremely and can be very rewarding as well, but it's also very difficult.
Yeah.
And I choose to be a musician, and there's nothing wrong with that. So yeah, it's funny. And I learned a lot from my buddy Steady, who was, you know, a one percenter, and many of my friends who are in, you know, motorcycle clubs. And I learn from people in every part of life, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, as far as riding, you know, goes, it's always going to be a part of my life. I'm always going to have a motorcycle. I have a 77 Shovelhead motor in my studio right now, sitting there, And in my mind, I'm building this bike. It may take 3 years, but it's there.
Yep.
It's there. I'm looking at it right now. I got 5-speed on the floor. I got the internals. I need a frame and a title, and I could get started. I got handlebars, tanks. So, you know, I'm always going to have a motorcycle. I just love it, you know?
Yeah. Oh, I do. So I think you mentioned this earlier, you know, bikes have turned up elsewhere in your work. I think bikes turned up in a couple of ways in the video for Old Man, which is a track that me and a billion other people just adore. And it's nice that Neil Young has, at least at some point in his life, been a Harley rider. So, you know, lots of legitimacy there, but it got me wondering, what do bikes mean to you as an artist, maybe especially as a songwriter? So you've just explained the separation there. Do they symbolize something? Are they useful to you?
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously the cliche thing is freedom, but there's a truth to that. But after a while, it becomes less about that and more about, because we're not really ever free. Sorry. You know, especially in LA, it's just red light, red light, red light, red light. It's like, and you got to pay your bills. You know what I mean? But yeah, for me, my music has always been visual, right? Like I see music in color. I see it in shapes. As far as the lyrics go, like I feel like I just love old soulful things. I love things with, you know, heavy patina. I like things that have been broken and fixed and broken and fixed again. There's just something endearing about that. And I relate my personality to something that's been broken and fixed and broken and fixed again. So to me, it's like, yeah, it's a super reflection of my personality. When I see other people's motorcycles and there's a conversation there, sometimes I don't even have to talk to them. I already know about them. I already know if they can ride, or I can already tell, you know, what kind of music they like just by looking at their machine. You know, it's like, so that for me is like, yeah, I think especially on this new album, Moonshine, it wasn't also just inspired by motorcycles. It was inspired by this old Econoline van that I found, which is like a boogie van, but they're really popular again in California. But, you know, and I throw my bike in it and drive the van up the coast now. And so I don't have to beat up on the old parts, you know. Try finding a 1948 rear cylinder head for a pan head if that doesn't cost $3,000 now on eBay.
Right.
Like they're just not around. So I'm actually now it's a salvage mission. And that's kind of why I'm building the shovel. The nose cone shovel is so that I can have a daily driver and not beat the crap out of my panhead. I rode it for 15 years and I love it. And it's time to just, you know, preserve it. So as far as motorcycles inspiring the music or machines in general for me. And tools, and like you go to like some of these old shops and there'll be an old lathe there. And it reminds me of my dad's lathe. And when he was doing cylinder heads for race cars, we had this old Sioux grinding machine. And when I was old enough to walk, he had me grinding valves, doing three angle jobs on valves when I was a kid. And he had all the stones laid out downstairs. And he must've had, oh, I don't know, 250 cylinder heads on the shelves in the basement, you know? And, you know, when he passed away, I mean, what were we going to do with all these heads? He still had 150 heads in the basement. Wow. And a lot of them were still stuff from the 70s that guys don't even want anymore. You know, just steel heads where you can go buy a nice set of cylinder heads for, you know, aluminum cylinder heads now, super cheap. So why would you try to spend $1,000 on these old? Anyways, I'm going off on a tangent, but I mean, things like that inspire me for my music. I don't know. It's just, I'm a huge Dylan fan, right? And I'm obviously a huge Neil Young fan. Bruce Springsteen. These guys wrote in a certain way. It was very poetic. And it creates an image. Just like a good poet, when you read the poetry, can all of a sudden take you somewhere. And that's the goal with my lyrics always, is just taking you somewhere. And you know, I try not to overthink it. You know, I'm trying to analyze and answer your question in the fairest way possible. But, you know, things like that inspire me. People inspire me, obviously, probably the most. But the machines and motorcycles and cars, they're definitely an aesthetic of mine.
Yep. That totally comes through. I mean, I think your music, as opposed to your lyrics, I hear that love of machines, you know, crystal clear. I think that's a very clear answer. So speaking of, when we first started kicking the idea of doing this podcast around, I think that Neil Peart had just passed away, and it was coincidentally right around the time you guys were about to release a cover of Rush's Working Man, which is outstanding, by the way. You know, Neil could kind of be a patron saint for motorcycle riding rock stars just because of the miles he put in, but also because of the role that riding ended up playing in his life. I'm sure it must have been devastating to hear that we had lost him at that moment. But I wonder if any part of your reaction had to do with, you know, being a fellow rider. How was that for you?
Well, I mean, it was sad. I mean, it's always sad to lose an artist because I've lived this life now for 20 years and, it feels like a few lifetimes already. And so I really empathize with just whether you're super successful or not, or you had the journey, or you can, you know, you continue to struggle with creating, writing, touring. And so, you know, when Neil passed, it was, you know, it's like when Gord passed there from the hip, you know what I mean? It's like, it sucks. It just sucks. And we lost Tom Petty. When Tom Petty died, I cried.
Yeah.
I was like, he was one of the most influential writers for me ever. So, I love the fact that he just got on the road. I know he was kind of more of an introvert kind of guy. Like, he didn't really talk to a lot of people. And I think he lost his wife, correct? And that's why.
And his daughter.
He kind of went on that journey.
And his daughter.
And his daughter.
Yeah.
So, like, a lot of pain, right? He was able to use it as therapy. And game of like a real musician, like a working musician. That's when I started to find bands like Led Zeppelin and Rush and started to understand what it is they were doing and how difficult things were and the sort of choices they were making.
Yeah.
And as far as drummers go, he's probably the best, if not top three of all time. Innovators, execution, stamina. Holy crap.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, just sit down and play drums for an hour, okay? And I'll see you.
Yeah.
I'll see you at the massage table.
Yeah.
Because it's brutal. It's brutal. And this guy was, you know, he'd play an hour solo. He was a maniac.
Yeah.
In the best way possible. It was sad. And, you know, it sucks because I really want him to hear it. I want him to hear what we did.
Yeah.
We did it 6 months before he passed away. So we had it in the can. I come from Hamilton, blue collar. Like, we want to do a really cool cover for this. We kicked around ideas for this album. And it was like, show up at the studio one day and my producer, Jimmy Messer, sitting there and he goes, he just doesn't even say anything. He just hits play. And it was Working Man. I go, that's it. I go, it's perfect.
Nice.
Let's do it. Now Neil didn't play on that record.
Yeah.
He didn't join the band till 74. That record was in 73. But he probably played that song a gazillion times.
Yeah, yeah.
If that's a real number. But, you know, so I'm sorry to make that about me again. I
no,
know
no, not
me,
at all.
That's how it affected me. But, you know, it did affect me, and you know, I mourned. And the other thing is this, man, it pisses me off is when you post something on social media mourning the death of one of your heroes, you should be allowed to do that, not take slack. I think a lot of people get upset that everyone sort of jumps on the bandwagon. No, we're not jumping on the bandwagon. We're giving a tribute to a person that affected us in our lives and loves. And no matter who it is we lose in this world that's influential and important, Kobe Bryant, rest in peace, most recently, you should be allowed to do that in your own way. Like, I wasn't a huge Kobe fan. I'm not a huge basketball fan. But I know what he did. I know what he did was important. And I know what he was about to do was even more important. Mm. And he contributed. He was epic. And so I mourn for the guy. I mourn for his family. Because I'm human, you know, and that's our connection. It's like, so the song's out. It's doing well. It's not doing as well as I'd like it to be. I really wish Canadian radio would get behind it, because, and not for me, because keep in mind, I'm not going to see any publishing money. It's not my song. I'm not making any money from it. Mm. Yeah, I just want the respect, you know. Respect would be nice, you know, but I think it's a really great cover. And I think, I just think, you know, radio is a tough one to crack, you know. We don't decide really what goes on the radio. So yeah, we just try to make good records.
Yeah, what else can you do?
But, yeah, that's my run on sentences with that. You can't do anything. And, you know, it's like we are only here for a short instant. So I think he probably... I mean, I know he affected so many people and he had a great life and, you know, and I not everybody gets to do what he did. So
no, that's right.
I think it is what it is.
Now, so one of the things that, you know, sort of crossed my mind thinking about that, and part of the reason I brought it up was that he, at a certain point in his career, used to ride from gig to gig, and he talked about it almost like it was therapy, to use your word. It seems to me like being in a rock band is incredibly hard work, and maybe harder now even than it was then. And so it made me wonder, how would you describe the role that riding plays in your life now? I think you've talked a bit about that, but I wonder if I ask you directly, how would you describe the role that pandemic plays?
It's a little absent. It's absent right now for me. You know, given my situation, you know, your situation sort of dictates your actions in this business. You kind of have to roll with it. If you have an ego and you're afraid of change, you're in trouble. Mm. And that's when I've gotten into trouble, you know, when the stubbornness comes out. And, you know, it's expensive my machine is expensive to operate because of its age and because of its value. And because, you know, you're in California, it's not as enjoyable as it once was. When I was touring heavy, the Panhead went in the trailer. And say we'd be in North Carolina, or we'd be in Raleigh or something, and we're going up to Asheville. I'd ride, and the guys would go behind me. I'd leave 2 hours early out of the hotel. I'd say, I'll see you at the gig. And I knew if something happened or I broke down and ran out of gas, I'd be on route. And they'd just see me on the side of the road and pick me up. There was a safety in that.
Right.
Which was nice. But I never did break down and run out of gas. But you never know with old bikes, man. Anything can happen. So I would do that. And I think I totally understand why Neil did that. And as I'm on the road traveling with bands, there's often, I would say, on the big bands who are running Prevos and like, 16-foot, 18-foot trailers, dual-axle trailers, there's a couple bikes in there. There's always a bike in there. Mm. And so somebody's riding. You know, so it's a common thing because we, even though we're on the road, there is it's the sense of being confined. We're confined to the schedule. We're confined to a bunk. We're confined to hotels. And the traveling, just because the country is so grand, the next gig might be 12 hours away.
Right.
So you're confined to those spaces. So the motorcycle allows you to widen the perspective and to just sort of feel human for a second and feel, you know, happy, you know, and just sort of, there's a different kind of energy, right? When you're flowing and the air's hitting you in a completely different way, it's a different, it's just a different feeling.
Right.
And it's not something you can explain to someone. You can get there a little bit in a convertible, but not, it's just not, you're still in a cage. So it's not the same thing as riding. And I really think that's where Neil got it when he would ride between gigs, you know, cause I did the same thing and it was like, yeah, there's, you don't, your mind kind of just kind of goes clear. It's almost Zen-like, isn't it? Like you're not thinking about all the little things that get us all cluttered up. It's cathartic, right?
Mm.
And I don't know. So that's what it is for me. And so when people say freedom, that's what they're talking about.
Right.
Freedom from their own mind, their own brain. And yeah.
Boy, that's a great insight. This idea that when you're on the road, you're not free. I mean, that kind of explains the whole thing. I think when the next time I hear, you know, John Bon Jovi singing, "I'm a Cowboy," I'm going to have a little more sympathy. And so it sounds
totally
right.
Yeah. No, totally. Yeah. Oh yeah. And worse than that, when you start to think about these other guys who are kind of writing these pop rock records and they're stuck to their genre and they won't go outside their own box. Like that's where I draw the line. I can't make the same record over and over again. A lot of guys do because it's branding, right?
Yeah.
The job, it's less of art and it's commercial art, which is totally fine because we all need that. We all need McDonald's once in a while.
Ouch. Shots fired.
That sounded super pretentious. But yeah. No. Did I just call Bon Jovi McDonald?
Maybe.
he's great. Okay, he's great.
So it sounds like I was going to ask you at some point. You know, I thought maybe it might be unfair to ask you to speculate, but I figured I'll take a chance. And you know, if Keanu Reeves writes to complain, it'll be fine with me. But you sort of dove into it a little bit. It sounds like you know of a lot of. Well, or many performers and musicians who ride. Is that a thing or is it just a stereotype? I feel like it's a thing.
I feel like it's a thing. I think you got to go into it case by case. I just know that of the guys who can afford it, most of them would do it. They don't have to be these crazy, super enthusiastic riders, you know?
Hmm.
Like when I play with Kid Rock, he didn't come in on his motorcycle. He came in a helicopter and the SUVs dropped and drove him right up the stage. He got out, played the show, went back in the SUV, drove the helicopter and flew home to Malibu.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, it's levels. Maybe he used to ride the gig. Now he feels like I want to be home for dinner and watch Netflix. You know, I think riding will always be a part of my life because I'm such a roots guy. I'm so romantic, and I'm such a traditionalist that I have to wrench on something. I have to paint something. I have to write something. It's just who my dad worked until the day he died. Hmm. It was just like, I think it's in my blood. You know what I mean? Like, and that may not be for everyone. So, you know, I always say to each their own, whatever makes you happy. You know, if you like riding on the weekends because you can, fantastic. If you can afford the shiniest, most brand new expensive motorcycle, do it.
Yeah.
Thank you. You know, let me go for a ride on it. Like I'm not knocking anybody who's earned their keep. And I, by the way, I'm not racist either. I stand for equality.
Mm.
And in race, to me, you know, when we were growing up, that meant you didn't like Japanese bikes or you didn't like British bikes. You had to ride a North American bike. And I think that's BS.
Yep.
I like them all. I like Chevys and Fords. I like Mercedes. I like Porsche.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, I like it all. I see these old Vincents and BSAs and Triumphs guys riding. They're sick. They're amazing. These old Japanese Yamaha Suzuki choppers in the 70s, you never see that in Canada. I came to California and these guys are riding the stuff. I was blown away.
Yeah.
Blown away. I was like, this is killer. And you know it too, being down here so much. You just see so much of where it came from, being in California. That was one of the big moves here, was number one, the music, obviously. And number two was the custom culture, you know, that it's their third generation. So they still have the stuff, and it was preserved. There's no rust down here, unless you're really close to the ocean. So to me, it's like, I don't know, this is the place to be for that kind of stuff. And all I'm saying is, if you ride, I get it. I'm never going to tell someone that, you know, well, you don't ride a jockey ship panhead, blah, blah, blah. I said, no, let's go for a ride. You know how to ride this? Go for it. Try it. You know, I'm not. When I first had that bike, Bruce, if someone looked at it, I'd get pissed off. It was like, you know, because I was young and I had an ego, and I was like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Someone breathed on it wrong. Now, people want to take a picture of that old bike. I say, yeah, sit on it. Try it out. Check it out. You know what I mean? I think I've evolved as a person, and I understand that it brings us together.
Yeah.
And that's at least I know that now, that it's there for everyone to enjoy if they want.
Yeah, I totally feel the same way. I've said this so many times. I think people are probably getting sick of hearing it, but to me, if a bike makes somebody happy, then it's a cool bike. And if somebody rides, then they're a cool person. And you're right. I mean, there's so much plurality down there. You know, there's just kind of everything. And I think that kind of promotes that inclusion. So I know a lot of entertainment industry people ride, especially in LA. I was at a motorcycle shop on Lincoln last week talking to the owner, and he was saying, well, this is Ben Affleck's bike and that's Queen Latifah's bike and so on. So it's obviously,
wait, Queen Latifah has a bike?
Yeah.
Kind of bike does Queen Latifah ride?
Are you ready for this? I don't know if I'm supposed to say,
yeah,
it's a Hayabusa, and I'm not even kidding. Isn't that fantastic?
Oh my God.
Oh my God.
That's incredible.
So even the most,
I've never been on a Hayabusa before.
It's well, people who love them. They were at the, you know, at one point in time, the king of the hill. So, you know, respect. I've heard that a lot of, you know, Hollywood types who ride do it because they love the safety and the anonymity of biker culture. And even when they're among other bikers with their helmets off, they just get to be bikers instead of being stars. I think you see this, you know, kind of at the rock star on a Sunday morning kind of thing. And I think you told me you ride with a group in Venice. Yeah. And I wondered whether that, you know, just being part of a crew and not being, you know, a rock star, if you'll forgive the term. I wonder if just being part of a crew is part of that attraction.
I don't really ride with them. I don't know if we had a misunderstanding there. I have ridden with them a few times. And they're not the only one. You know, I've ridden with Hell's Angels guys. I've ridden with different club guys. Power Plant Choppers, a lot of those guys. Sometimes I'll ride with one person, you know, who's a friend. For me, as being a musician, and it's part of my personality is just to kind of be out there and learn from people and tell their story. So for me, it's like, I don't want to ever be confined to one group. I don't know if that's bad or good. I just know that that's kind of who I am. Yes, to answer your question, it's always nice to be a person. Here's the question that gets everyone in LA, that it gets me too. What do you, not even in LA, what do you do?
Right.
Because if you meet someone, how are you? What do you do? You know, instead of like, who are you? You know, as a person.
Yeah.
What kind of things do you like? You know, it's like I think that ghost kind of carries over into riding.
Yeah.
Well, how long you been riding? Well, it's like getting a tattoo. Well, when you start getting tattoos? Well, you got to start with one.
Right.
You're going to knock me because I only have one tattoo? Like, I've been getting tattooed for 15 years, but at one point I had one tattoo. And tattoo guys are going, whatever. You know what I mean? It's just, maybe that's just a quality thing, right?
Yeah.
You know, where it's like, I would never go up to someone and say that. I would be like, that's an awesome tattoo. I'm so glad you contributed to that culture. Tell me about the story. What was it like? Who tattooed you? Where did you get it done? To me, it's a conversation.
Yeah.
It's an event. And that's part of being human. So it's like, don't hate, man. Appreciate. I know it sounds formal and maybe too obvious, but it's like, actually do it. Actually be it. When you catch yourself judging, you know, stop. Maybe catch yourself and say, hey, you know what, man, I need to relax because I was that guy too or that girl too.
Mm.
And, you know, they may not be as educated. So educate them. You know, guys ask me all the time when I'm on the road, hey, what should I do? I want to be a career musician. I go, how much time do you have? You know, not like good. Good luck, kid. Quit while you're ahead.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because that's just like, figure it out. I did. You know, it's like, no, dude, I ask you a question. Just be nice. Maybe that's my Canadian. There's still a bit of Canadian left in me.
Yeah.
where I like to be nice. But where were we? Where were we? What was the original? I run on like crazy.
No, it's awesome. I was just wondering whether the sort of the cover of a writing group was kind of a relief for you as a, you know, as somebody who might be recognized and
right.
Yeah.
So the answer is, yeah, I just, to me, it's like, yeah, just be yourself. You don't always have to be on camera.
Yeah.
You don't always have to be in the studio recording, you know, there's other conversations to be had. And I think rock stars and people who are famous influencers, I think they get a bad rap because it seems like because of their outlet, it becomes a vanity thing. It seems because people want to know what they're into, or they're just visually in front of everybody so much that you have preconceived notions of who they are. And after hanging out with a lot of musicians who are very well known and actors who have done some great things, I find that it's a mixed bag. And I think often I'm very surprised at how normal they are.
Yeah, that's somehow reassuring. And I hear that about a lot of, you know, if you like, famous people who ride. But of course I can't control for the ones who don't, but it strikes me somehow that the ones who are motorcyclists seem to be, you know, more down to earth folks.
I think, you know, motorcycling is riding is, yeah, it's maybe not for everyone, but it could be. There's definitely a point where you got to jump, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You got to give it a shot. And I think it can be intimidating, I think, to some people. But
yeah, which I suppose is probably also true of being a musician. I still choke up in front of an audience myself. So just as an aside, you mentioned being a Canadian. I wondered how you feel about LA traffic. I'm pretty positive about it, but I'm a tourist and I tend to stay on the west side anyway, so I don't have to live with it. How's that been?
Yeah, I mean, I've been here 11 years and it's the worst it's ever been. It's horrible.
Yeah,
it's horrible. There's no doubt about it. And people are just not paying attention. There's an accident, I think it's every 7 seconds in LA, the greater LA. Car accident every 7 seconds. I was trying to look at the statistic. I could be wrong. You can look this up, but there's thousands of motorcycle accidents too a year, which are never good.
Nope.
You know, and I'm like, so you got to factor that in. You know, to me, the riding doesn't get good till I get out of LA.
Yeah.
I mean, truthfully, I mean, after living here this long, it's not fun to go split lanes on the highway and through the city to go 10 miles to the studio.
Yeah.
It's just not fun. It's a gauntlet every time I go out. And it's now it's necessity. And especially if I'm on something as gnarly as a 50 panhead, it looks cool as hell, but cool doesn't matter. at the end of the day, when it comes to, you know, being safe and your, and protecting your livelihood. So, so yeah, the traffic has gone so bad. You experienced it, but you know, and the problem is in Los Angeles, there's no good time to go anywhere.
Right. Yep.
I go 30 miles to my buddy's place in Thousand Oaks. It's an hour and a half. And then, and it, maybe at like 10 o'clock at night, I can get home in like 40 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and it's like, so yeah, I mean, you try to live as close as you can to your work, and it's really important and healthy to get out of town, go up to Big Bear or something like that, or Lake Arrowhead, or, you know, go north up to Ventura and, or south down to San Diego or, you know, places along the way.
Yeah.
Even better. My buddy Chris Stacey lives in Dana Point. He shot a lot of our music videos. He's from Burlington, Ontario. And he's down here now. And yeah, so I mean, it's a shame, but you know, it's still a great place to live. It's just hard to get anywhere. And the other thing is that they get, you know, if you don't get hit, or you're going to get scratched and bumped.
Yep.
So it's really hard to have something nice. It's impossible to park anywhere. And if you miss your meter by 3 seconds, the guy is slapping a $70 parking ticket on your window. I mean, that's a fact.
Yep. Yes, it is.
It's like there is a meter made for every two cars. it's just out of control, man. It's like they're waiting around the corner for you.
Yeah.
It's just like, wow. Yeah. So you got to be, you know, you got to be aware of your surroundings. And the street cleaning thing is another thing. It's like, you got to shuffle your car. If you do get a spot, you got to make sure, you know, there's 8 signs there and you're trying to read it and it's in a foreign language. And, but yeah, so I don't really look forward to driving in the city. And, what's a good thing now is I live in a little place called Culver City, which is kind of in between, you know, Venice and downtown and sort of adjacent to Hollywood and all. It's really great. And it reminds me a lot of Canada. Culturally, it's eclectic. There's every kind of restaurant, every kind of people walking around. It really reminds me of home.
Yeah.
It's quiet. There's this really bad homeless problem in Los Angeles. I think we've got like 60 or 70,000 on the books that are homeless, which is a lot of people, and it's tough. So Culver City is kind of like this little cul-de-sac where it feels more neighborhoody.
Yeah.
And there's not, it's clean and there's families. And that's, so that's a nice change for me. And so everyone's looking at me like I'm the crazy tattoo rocker dude. And I'm like, okay, well, if I'm the crazy guy in the neighborhood, I'm in the right neighborhood. I'm exaggerating. I love my neighbors and everybody here is usually connected to the industry in some way. Like I'm 3 blocks from Sony Studios, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's a pretty cool area that's happening. I knew I'd get some energy for that question. So I guess, you know, sort of back to the main topic. I mean, this may seem like a sort of simple-minded question to ask, but I'm going to ask it anyway. If it's possible, so you started writing, I think you said at 24, and I think I read somewhere that you started playing the guitar at 21. So that's a lot of big, you know, kind of turning points in your life as these things turn out. And I wonder if you think, especially among people in your business, do you think that bikers are more likely to be musicians, or do you think that musicians are more likely to turn into bikers? Or is the spirit of that question workable?
I don't know the answer to that. I really don't. I don't know, man. That's really funny. I don't think there's the right answer though. That's really, it's true in my case, I started out as, I was making hip hop records when I was a kid, 16. Like I was, before I was really heavy influenced into like the folk and the rock and then the heavy rock and like then Sabbath and all that stuff. Before I really got into that, I was listening to 90s rap. Well, we were calling it hip hop. That was the golden age of hip hop. And those guys were some of the best lyricists in the world and poets. And it's really kind of where I started my craft.
Yep.
And so I was just after 4 years of sampling and struggling to get my ideas across to people who can play, I just decided to play. So for me, I'm sort of this idiot savant who did everything backwards.
Right.
You know, it was, you know, I learned the other way. I was self-taught everything. I used to just go watch guitar players play and then just copy them. It was before YouTube videos. And you could do learning videos. See, yeah. If I had that, I might be a lot better player than I am now. I had to go figure this stuff out. I had to listen and just keep playing until I figured it out, you know? And, and there's no right answer to what you said, but I've never been afraid to be made a fool of. So if I was going to go ride a motorcycle and be the worst rider in the world, or fall maybe, or have the nerdiest bike, the cheapest, crappiest bike, I was going to do it.
Yep.
I was going to do it. I'll take the shot. I'll always take the shot. And I would just say to people, regardless of where you are in your life, take the shot. You got nothing to lose. If you don't like it, you don't like it. You know, it's not for you. It's not for you. But I think there is more of a code, I think, definitely, and an understanding and a respect for the road as a motorcycle rider.
Yep.
After riding for several years, I became a much better driver and just saw things in a different way, in a different light.
Yeah, me
so
too.
For that, you know, I think so. Right. I mean, if I would ask, you know, 9 out of 10 guys, they'd probably say you're right.
Yeah.
It's just a known thing. And so,
yeah. It's a funny thing. I'm amazed at the number of riders I know who are musicians. There are a couple of fellow podcasters that play, you know,
right.
Like, and in some cases pretty well. I don't play very well, but there are those who do. It's just funny how these things seem to go together.
There's something about being a musician that's kind of like, you know, against the grain. And there's something about riding a motorcycle that's against the grain. It's not common.
Yeah.
So maybe that's it. You know, it's just like I'm my own person and this is how I express it. Because often when we're on the motorcycle, we're solo.
Yeah.
We're one up, you know? Yeah. So it's like, you know, people who kind of do their thing their own way. And that's why it's kind of fun to go on rides with packs and meet people who ride together. Cause it's like, oh yeah, now I got it. Now I got a crew.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, I hear you.
That clicks. Do you get bikers showing up at your shows, identifying themselves as such? Do people, you know, try to connect with you as a rider?
All the time.
Yeah.
All the time. In fact, I don't think there's a show in the last 10 years where there wasn't a guy with a patch on or with a vest, or there wasn't like 4 or 5 motorcycles out parked right outside the venue all the time.
How do you feel?
And they come right up to you and I come right up to them, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's pretty cool.
You like that? You know, and yet it's funny. There are so many artists of one kind or another who keep the fact that they ride to themselves. You know, when I'm talking to people who, you know, who aren't riders or who aren't, you know, kind of into the motorcycle culture, and I say, well, look, here's 45 people that are famous that ride that you didn't know rode, it always blows them away. You know, I didn't even know that Bruce Springsteen rode until that story about his bike breaking down in New Jersey a couple of years ago. I think Billy Joel built that bike for him. I wondered, why do you think?
Oh yeah, Billy Joel rides a lot. He's got a bunch of Indians, actually. Billy Joel,
yeah,
pretty sick by collision.
Which apparently you can go ahead and see. Yeah, no, that you're absolutely right. I just wondered why you thought artists would choose to be private about the fact that they ride. I realize I'm asking you to speculate, but I'm curious to know what you think.
I have no idea.
Yeah.
I have no idea.
Fair enough.
I mean, some people don't want to talk about stuff. I don't know. Like, I don't know. For me, I'm an open book. I got nothing to hide. Well, I have a few things that I care not to let the,
it keeps you interesting, I guess.
The fine the fine people of the Los Angeles Police Department to know, but I will say, other than that, I have nothing to hide.
Nothing to hide.
Yeah, and I don't know, man. Like, I find, you know, if people don't like to talk about stuff. There's two types of people for musicians anyways. There's people that don't really understand it themselves as far as the music goes, or it's not really their baby. It's accumulation of people around them. So they're insecure, in other words, of what I'm saying about what they've created. And then there's other people that want to leave it open to interpretation. They want to create some mystery, and they don't want to tell you exactly what that song may be about.
Mm.
And I respect both. But for me, I'm not in the position where I'm established enough and people understand me enough that I don't need to explain how I got there. Because it's part of the story.
Yep.
And because I am a blue collar guy and grew up the way I grew up, I want to have people relate to my message and what it is I'm putting out there.
Right.
So I'm always going to talk about me being a writer, you know? And, I think that's what maybe, I mean, it's up to the individual, you know?
Well, I think maybe you've just explained it. I mean, I think, you know, motorcycles, they carry a certain amount of symbolic freight. And so, you know, Kaz is a motorhead from Hamilton, Ontario, and he's got deep working class roots, and those values are part of who he is, and motorcycles are part of that life. So it makes sense that they'd be part of your story.
Right.
But I can't explain Springsteen, but there are lots of riders. You know, I think about people like Alanis Morissette or Pink, you know, who are both riders, who I wonder if they keep it quiet because it just doesn't fit the personal brand. It doesn't fit the persona. And that's what your answer sort of made me think.
I remember seeing Bruce with anyways, no, it doesn't matter. We can go run on for that for days, but yeah.
I'm not going to turn down a Bruce Springsteen story. Come on.
I don't have a personal one. I just know that, when we were on the shore, he had this club that he used to play every week called the Stone Pony. And I had the pleasure of playing that a couple times. And it's just a dumpy little dive bar. And for me, if he rides, it makes total sense because it's like that part of town.
Right.
It's totally that part of town. I hear it. So I was like, to me, it's like, oh, yeah, of course. I don't think that he... Some people are like branding the badass thing. Like Kid Rock, he rides and stuff, and maybe he didn't start riding until he was 34. I don't know. You know, maybe he started riding when it made sense for his brand to ride. I don't know Bob that well, so
yeah,
I can't say. He would have to tell me. But there's a good chance that he was riding when he was younger because it was like Flint and Detroit.
Yeah,
and that's what you did there when you know, and he was doing things. And this was a Bruce Springsteen that turned Kid Rock story, but he was doing things that were totally off the hook. He was a white DJ in a black culture. Like he was just looking to get his ass kicked, you know, and he didn't care. He did it because he loved it.
Yeah.
So like, you know, I can't say enough about people like that.
Yeah.
They're pioneers in their own right. And for me, it's like, yeah, I mean, I'm always trying to find my way and I'm always trying to try to take a different road. That's where I am creatively. And that's where I am with the motorcycle. That's why I want to try to build this shovel head with perhaps even a working suspension might be nice so I can go on longer rides.
Yeah.
You know?
So let's talk about hardware for a second. I wonder if you know this, that the electric guitar was invented by a motorcycle racer, a guy named Paul Bigsby. And I guess they found his first guitar a couple of years ago, and there's a video online. You can watch it being played, which is kind of awesome. And so it sort of got me wondering, and again, this is kind of maybe it's a lame question, but do you think bikes and guitars have something in common?
Well, I mean, they both kick ass, that's for sure.
You're both shiny, and you can never have too many.
I think you can never have too many. That's great. You know what? They do have something in common. You know, because especially, you know, in their inception, right? It was something that was different. It was something that looked, you know, when the first band started coming out, they started playing electric rock, and they got out of church gospel country lanes, respectively. It was like it was against the culture. It was anti-culture sort of. And motorcycles were the same way. You know, they were kind of like I said, they were going against the grain. So and you know, like I have a 1963 Gretsch Firejet. It's like one of my prized possessions. It's I'm the third owner. It's the only left-handed Gretsch built in 1963 to our knowledge to date.
Wow.
And I hope someone hears this and goes, "Hey, I got one." Sitting on it is custom handmade. I would love to hear that. So I'm putting it out there. That's the only one. It's Corvette red, mahogany body. It's inlaid. All the parts have been flipped upside down because they were just trying to figure it out. Mm-hmm. And they were making Gretches in New York in a factory. I believe it was Brooklyn. And Fred Gretsch was the guy. So long story short, you know, you if you look at like Milwaukee and those guys built and pioneering these Harleys, the early stuff was pioneering, and they were just figuring it out how it all worked and engineering. And I'll tell you what, this Firejet I have is the coolest, most badass playing guitar that I'll probably ever own, you know? And yeah, I mean, for me, it's like the red on the guitar matches the red on the bike, you know, and it has the same, like, it was just like, there it is. It was an aha moment. Whereas like, you know, that personal aesthetic of mine, that thing sounds in the terms of like, what a guitar sounds like, it's supposed to sound like, you know, for me, it's like my Panhead sounds like what a motorcycle is supposed to sound like. Like there is nothing like an early Panhead. Nothing sounds like that. Knuckleheads have a specific sound. Panheads sound a certain way.
Yeah.
Right. Cause of the pan tops, the echo a certain way. The top end sounds a certain way. The low end had a lot more beef in it. Mine's stroked and bored, so it's more thumps, got a little lumpy cam in it, you know, and it's got, you know, open headers. So it's like, oh yeah, that bike sounds correct. It, you know, it's like the way in a hot rod, you know, big block Chevys have their own sound and old Fords have their own sound. They sound very distinctively different. And that's the same with guitars. They sound very distinctively different. You know, an SG sounds different than a Les Paul.
Yeah.
And they're made by the same company.
Yeah.
And that's why guys have, you know, several different guitars when we're making records, because you can go to the shelf and be like, no, man, I want this thing to sound telly, nice and bright. Give it to Mike Campbell. You know, there it is. So we got an early 50s telly at the studio because we use it. And you get that sound. And you totally get that sound. You have to have that guitar. So maybe in that way, there's definitely some comparisons, you know?
Yep.
But to me, it's like America. When I say Americana, it's just like, that was the best stuff. I think, you know, I don't know what younger guys are coming up and feeling, but I was fortunate enough to be exposed to the culture through my father and through some really great musicians in Hamilton. What stuff was really supposed to sound like, how you're supposed to use it, how it works, you know?
Yeah.
Like my Panhead, you can't feather that thing. You can't baby it. You got to stomp on it. You got to jam that clutch and smash the ratchet. Like you got to drive the thing like you're racing it all the time.
Yeah,
because that's how it works.
Well, and that sounds.
We took a brand new Harley. Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say that sounds exactly like a guy who likes vintage hollow body guitars and tube amps, and you know, you want all this stuff to be physical,
right?
Was that a fair statement?
right. Yes. That's definitely why those are sort of my go-tos.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. I mean, we were playing with a lot of heavy rock bands and they had all their solid state amps in road cases. And then me and Julian would roll up the stage and we'd have our like orange tube amp and I got a supersonic 60 watt and a bassman. And like, we're pulling all this old gear out and they're just looking at us, shaking their heads. They're going, these guys are nuts. These guys are nuts, man. They're playing vintage tube amps on, on a festival, on an outdoor festival where it might rain. And our guitars are just, because they're hollow body or whatever, they don't acclimate as well as like a new Les Paul would, you know, when you put it up. And by that, I mean, it goes out of the bus or van into an outdoor stage and the temperature's, 10, 15 degrees different. That guitar is going to move. The neck's going to move. Everything changes. So when you sit it out there, you're just hoping it, you sit it out there. I usually give it an hour or two just to acclimate and then keep tuning it. Cause it just goes out. You play one song and then it's done. So it's warfare for sure. But to me, that's part of the charm. It's part of the fun. It's part of the experience. That's why I ride an old Harley, is because anything can happen at any given time. And to me, it's not but it doesn't feel like a chore. It's just more exciting.
Yeah.
And that comes off, to other people. So.
I think so too. I mean, I think there's a lot to be said for intention, no matter what your art is. And I relate, I think probably lots of writers, although clearly not all writers, relate to this idea that things are a little more satisfying when they're, when they're interactive and when they're, difficult. So I get that. And I kind of get it about music too, but boy, people must just scratch their heads when you bring an amplifier in that has to be warmed up.
Yeah. We put them on stage and, or in the back and we'll flip them on, leave them on for, I leave my amp on about an hour before I play. And you try and squeeze as much as you can out of it, but then you get a lot more tone that way. And it all depends. Honestly, it's always situational. It depends on what size room and who you're playing to and how many people soak up the sound. And so there's a lot of what kind of mics you use, the mic, the guitar amps. There's just so many factors that go into it. But I don't knock anybody, like I said, that gets on their motorcycle, rides to work every day, and push a button. Like, to me, that sounds comforting in the best way possible. Like, for me, I'm at the point in my life where I kind of want a daily driver. That's why I'm either going to build a shovel or get a newer bike so I can, like I said, preserve the pan, not kill it, not kill myself, and be able to get to, where I need to be without having to think of the route, the setup. Let me just check the push rods in the distance because I want to make sure the valves are opening correctly. Mm. Checking my oil every 5 seconds. You know what I mean? Like, just making sure because I run an open primary, just making sure everything's tracking straight. Like, I can't just hop on my bike, kick it over and go because my life depends on it. So I kind of got to go over it every couple rides. I got to tighten everything because the things are nuts. So part of me is like, a buddy of mine lent me his Triumph for 3 weeks and I had a blast with it. It was a brand new, I think they're called New Church or something like that. It's like a 900.
Yep.
I think that's what it is. It's like a Bonnie, right?
Yeah. It's a type of Bonnie.
Anyway, man, I had a ton of fun with that thing. It was great. So I appreciate the new stuff too, for sure.
I'm curious, do you have a motorcycling rock star hero? Is there anybody from the history of rock and roll and motorcycling that in terms of how they live and what they stood for kind of inspires you in some way?
I don't think so. I can't think of anything off the top of my head specifically, because to me, like I said, I'm a musician first and foremost. So I always, to me, more so than the lifestyle, the only guy I could think of, but he never rode, is Billy Gibbons. Mm. I mean, he may have ridden, but he's a hot rod guy. But if you're talking of in terms of guys that have inspired me for what they live, how they live, what they put first, their aesthetic, and just their overall coolness and vibe and spreading the love. And just, Billy is like, he would be my dad. He was born in 49. So
yeah.
My dad was born in 49. So Billy's like his second father. I mean, I mean, Jimi Hendrix said he was one of his favorite guitar players. So, and I mean, in the hot rod culture, he always had something cool, from Cadzilla, well, from the Eliminator to the Cadzilla and to all these other. And he did build a bike that matched Cadzilla too. So I don't know if he ever rode it, but you know,
that's a great answer. Actually,
he just had someone. What's his name now? It'll come to me after this interview is over. But you know, he just recently did like a 34 Ford. That's great. And for me, it was always music first, and they always felt like these guys were like the real rock and rollers. You know, the authentic guys. You can just smell it. You know.
Yeah.
And it's like those guys who weren't trying too hard. They were doing something cool. Those were the ones who influenced me. And a lot of hip hop artists were like that. Like I said, early on for me, hip hop artists did that for me. You know, there was like a band called Tribe Called Quest that was really great. It was a huge influence writing wise. Nas was a massive influence. People like that. There was a lot of underground hip hop that I really liked. You know, Lords of the Underground, they were really cool. DOS Effects, they were more commercial. But this is like some of that early, like I said, that golden age stuff. For me, that sort of set the page for my writing. Mm-hmm. And then they didn't have hot rod culture, but they were against the system because they were being scrutinized and they had it harder than anyone else.
Yeah.
And for me, there was something that I could really look up to and respect immediately. And then I thought these are heroes. So, you know, and when I see other guys doing it their way, I go, yeah, that's how I want to live my life. And it's gotten tougher than ever now to do it because of there's so much traffic now, but somehow I maintain, because I guess I'm not putting the result before the process.
Right.
And every time I do that, I start to become really unhappy.
Yeah, I get that.
And it's like, no, dude. Now I'm going to become a poser, because that's what I said. If I have to ride that motorcycle every day because of my image, it's bullshit.
Yep,
it's bullshit. I can't ride my bike right now because I'm thinning out my overhead so that I can do music. So because I don't want anything to break, and then I got my van, and you know what I mean? I go to the studio every day, so I'm just taking some time off of riding and other things, you know, so I can just continue to do what I love and enjoy the process. And the other that stuff will come again. And once someone will go, hey, Kaz, I got a bike for you. You want to go for a ride? Yes, let's go. You know what I mean? Like, that'll always be there for me. So, yeah, I mean, and that's just being a musician, right? And maybe that's not even just being a musician. Maybe that's just being a hardworking person who you know, is living paycheck to paycheck. Maybe that's what I am. So, you know, for me right now, that's a luxury, living in my situation in California.
Yeah.
And then other times it's been great. I've had a couple cars and a bike. And you know what I mean? It's just, you ride this crazy wave. That's why my family just like, I couldn't do it. And the other people are like, I can't do what you do, you know? Yeah. Like, there's too many unknown factors. But that's where I say I have to put the result second.
Yep. Well, I think you can hear it in your music. I mean, the thing that keeps coming through to me here is that you're determined to keep it real in a business that it makes that very difficult. And I love that that's how you look at riding. Right. So you've got a new album coming out in March. Is there going to be anything on this album that bikers should perk up their ears to? Anything especially for us?
Well, all of it. All of it. No, it's for everyone. You know, my records are for everyone.
Yeah.
And I think everyone can take something away from it. And, you know, there's going to be parallels because, like I said, our personalities, there's so many similarities and people can relate to that. But, you know, it's an old, It's a soulful rock album. You know, it's something that I've always wanted to make. And, you know, as I get older and I become more experienced, for me, my taste is more refined and more specific. And actually what happened is in that, it's like, a lot of sounds and instruments went away. A lot of over singing and maybe overwriting kind of went away. And I find like the simplest stuff is sometimes the hardest stuff to write. And so, you know, really taking from sort of that late 60s, early 70s rock sound when drums were a little deader and there's one guitar. And like I said, it's more defined and authentic. It's like this, you know, you can have this crazy extensive meal with all the flavors in the world, or you can cook a really good steak with salt and pepper. And a guy who can do that and cook a really good steak, it could be the best meal you ever had. You know, sometimes you don't need all the extras. So I'm hoping that people, especially fans from previous records of ours, can understand that and will love it and fall in love with it. And I hope that in that way, it will have more longevity. You'll be able to live with it longer and enjoy the things and the simplicity and not overthinking. And there's a lot of candidacy and moments on the record where it's real. You know, we did three takes. We took the best take and really did it, you know. So I'm really proud of it, man. I'm really excited for it. It's probably going to be late April.
Okay.
Pushing it back, which is the benefit of being on an independent record label.
I'm excited to hear it.
That's all I got on that. I just, you know, it's for people to enjoy.
Well, it's hard not to notice a pattern here that this is sort of stripped down, honest, you know, respect for tradition thing. So I'm kind of, especially now that we've talked, I'm super excited to hear the album when it comes out. And you may recall last winter we had a chance to watch you guys work a little bit in the studio, and I was blown away by how much heart and kind of genuine art went into that process. That it you were not making a product, you were making something that mattered to you. And corny as it sounds, I came away with a very strong impression of that. So I hope it comes back to you when this album comes out.
That's awesome. Yeah. Oh, me too. Yeah, no, thanks. And I'm really happy you got to experience the day with us there. And you're welcome anytime, of course. I know you usually plan your one year trip down here.
Yeah.
Which is, now you must have some good roots laid down here now. You've been here a few times, you know the places to hit and the people to see. So that's really cool.
Yeah, it's become a second home. I realize I sound pretentious about it, but I love it. It's like another life that, you know, I wish I'd had when I was 25, but I'm happy to get a little taste of it now. It's a cool place, and in some way, that's what motorcycles mean to me too. So it's I'm a lucky guy.
Oh yeah, for sure, You and I both.
Yeah. Well, this has been a ton of fun. It's just flown by, but we're like 15 minutes past the time I promised I would let you go. So I guess I better.
Yeah. Well, we can. I'm sure you'll be good on the edit. We can take some out. Take the crappy ones out. Yeah.
Sorry. It's all gold. I've had your music in my head for the last 2 weeks, looking forward to this, and that has not been a hardship. I really appreciate you speaking with me. And, you know, good luck with everything that's in front
problem.
Of you. Take care.
Yep, we'll be in touch. And thank you so much.
It's a pleasure.
We'll talk soon.
Thank you. Bye now. Well, it's been a few years since I thought rock and roll could explain life to me, but maybe I should have kept the faith. What might be the defining moment in this conversation came when I asked Kaz whether musicians are inclined to become writers or if it was the other way around. As interview questions go, it wasn't exactly brilliant, but his answer kind of was. He said, in essence, it's not that one of those things causes the other. It's that the same kind of individual is inclined to do both of them. Someone who is compulsively authentic and who refuses to hide themselves. I'm my own person, he said of his life, and this is how I express it. So it turns out that a lot of rock stars ride motorcycles for the same reasons that you and I do. Not because it imparts some kind of image, but exactly because riding is an antidote to all that. Because it keeps us grounded and real and in the here and now, and reminds us that nothing is permanent and that our fate is in our own hands. For all of its pleasures and all the things that make it cool, riding a motorcycle is still one of the most real things most of us do in our lives. And even if our true selves don't have thousands of screaming fans, well, that will always remain maybe its greatest gift. Well, thanks for listening. You'll find show notes for this episode at thismotorcyclelife.com. That's also how you can reach me if you have questions, comments, or suggestions, and how you can sign up for my weekly newsletter. If you're already a subscriber, I hope you're enjoying it. Emailing me at thismotorcyclelife@gmail.com works too, and I will definitely get back to you. You can also follow me on Instagram, where I like to post pictures of bikes I find on the street, and where you can find a lot of the people I've interviewed for this podcast, including Mark Kaspersick. He's Red Light King. Not surprisingly, this episode's playlist recommendation is about being who you are, and there really wasn't a second choice. The band is Red Light King, and the track is Working Man. Buy it or stream it wherever you like to get your music, and in the meantime, keep staying alive out there.
It seems to